Thomas Ridd paints a picture by putting it plainly. We live in an age of disinformation. For a through line on this podcast, I will most often reference Russian disinformation, or desinformatsiya. We define disinformation in three main ways. One, this information is put out methodically. Two, content and sources may be doctored and online accounts may be inauthentic. And three, it's usually intended to weaken a target. In this case, that's us in the United States. The volume of information out there makes it extra hard to distinguish between fact and fiction. And my biggest question is, what is all this doing to us? You're listening to A Lot of Good People Told Me, and I'm your host, Alex Rose. Wow. Okay, so today my guest is Renee DiResta. She is the technological research manager at Stanford's Internet Observatory. At the behest of CISI, that's the Senate Intelligence Committee, Renee led an investigation into the Russian Internet Research Agency, and she presented public testimony. A year later, she led an additional investigation into influence capabilities that the GRU, that's the Russian intelligence, used alongside its hack and leak operations in the 2016 election. She studied influence operations and computational propaganda in the context of pseudoscience conspiracies, terrorist activity, and state-sponsored information warfare. She has advised Congress, the State Department, and other academic, civil society, and business organizations on the topic. I really want y'all to understand who I got to speak to and wish I could have spoken to her for hours. Hi, Renee. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've spent a lot of time and years studying the Russian disinformation campaigns that came out of the IRA, Internet Research Agency, in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about that work and how you happened into that.
Sure. So in October of 2015, I had done some work with the Obama administration as an outsider looking at the problem of ISIS on social media, looking at the problem of terrorist kind of abuse of Twitter and Western social platforms. And in the course of doing that work, we were very interested in what kind of solution space was there, right? Beyond just takedowns, how should the government think about this evolving form of propaganda and what our appropriate responses to it. And at the time, one of the things that we were discussing was the fact that while ISIS was quite visibly doing it, a number of state actors clearly had the capability to run propaganda campaigns, particularly covert propaganda campaigns. And Adrian Chen's article, The Agency, had in fact come out several months prior, detailing his sort of fascinating encounter with the Internet Research Agency. Now, the Internet Research Agency wasn't new, of course. It had run campaigns such as targeting Ukraine during the invasion of Crimea. So this was not a new idea that state actors would use these tools. The question really was, how do we respond? And in a kind of series of unfortunate decisions, we really didn't do very much in the way of response. And I don't think anybody really took the problem as seriously then, because nobody really had a sense of the full scope of what was going on. Fast forward a little bit, into kind of early 2017, there was a investigative journalist who noted the presence of a fake Black Lives Matter page. And through some digging, I began to believe that this was affiliated with the Internet Research Agency. And this was very, very fascinating to those of us who had in 2015 kind of expected this to happen. Knew it was happening, in fact. And so it was almost like a breadcrumb for some of us who began to search for more of this content online, began to try to look for other IRA pages, other IRA accounts. There was kind of a breakthrough when a researcher named Jonathan Albright found some data from a handful of pages that had come down via a tool called CrowdTangle. And all of a sudden, we had some content to work with. We had some phrasing. We could see the topics they were talking about. And in the course of this, that was happening kind of on one thread. But nobody was, nobody believed that this was only a Russian effort at this point. Really, there was a recognition that this was sort of the future of political campaigns, that people were, going to create fake accounts, you know, botnets at the time were a really big deal. Fake pages were, you know, seen as kind of political dirty tricks, but also it was still a little bit more people kind of messing around with this new system to see what it could be used for.
Yeah, a little more experimental.
Yeah. And so I was having conversations just around, you know, what was possible, where what from marketing was making its way into politics domestically. What from state, you know, what was happening with these state actor things we were finding, what was happening with fake news, which was actually wholly separate from the Russia dynamic. And so all of these things kind of came together. And as it became clear that social networks had potentially had a profound impact in how people got their information during that campaign, the question of how should we investigate this dynamic became, you know, quite a prominent topic of conversation. And specific to the state actor activity, Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, Google, had identified the presence of the Internet Research Agency having political conversations on their platforms. That data was turned over to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the Intelligence Committee staffers, you know, recognizing that they didn't necessarily have in-house technical expertise to go through, you know, several hundred gigs of material, reached out to a few outside researchers. I was one of them, and asked if we would be interested in fielding teams, basically, in which we didn't know who the other researchers were. We didn't know who else had access. But the point was really to look at the data sets that the platforms had turned over. And that was how, you know, how I came to be doing that work.
When you encountered some of this content, was it immediately apparent what the goals were of the content, or was that something you sort of discovered later on? I mean, was it pretty standard from a disinformation playbook?
So yes and no. So I think one of the things that I've tried to convey in my work over the years is what does connect back to active measures and disinformation campaigns, right? These are not new. Propaganda is not new. Propaganda leveraging racial tension particularly is not new. It's something that, you know, it was actually one of the main narratives that the Soviet Union used during Cold War propaganda campaigns. The idea that America did not have any kind of moral high ground to stand on in critiquing communism or, you know, atrocities in the Soviet Union when we had people being lynched in the US. This was actually a very common rejoinder. And so the, you know, it wasn't so much that it was new. The question for me was how had the propaganda adapted to the technological infrastructure on which it was being disseminated, right? And that's where you see the move from long form content, what we called narrative laundering, where a front media property or a fake journalist or a person secretly working for someone else, you know, secretly working for a foreign government, would plant a story in the hopes that other people would pick up the story and that would kind of move through the media ecosystem. That was how this used to happen. But in the age of social media, anyone can be a media of one, right? Anyone can toss up a Facebook page. And so the kind of the manifestations that they used were that, you know, we are the real independent media. We are the grassroots voices that are telling you the truth of what is happening in the world. And that framing, that kind of counterculture, anti-media, anti-mainstream tone is actually huge on social media, period, right? It's not limited to state actors. That is, in fact, you know, a lot of people distrust media. A lot of people believe that some, you know, random independent media of one type person or an influencer is more trustworthy. And so that was what they made themselves. In this media environment, that's how you amass influence. And so we looked at both the network, right? So we were doing both quantitative analysis, saying, you know, who tweets to whom, who retweets whom, what real people get sucked into the dynamic, and what is the dissemination pathway on Twitter. We also looked at that same dynamic on Instagram and Facebook. Who is cross-posting to whose account? You know, who is signal boosting other, you know, somebody else's page content? This was huge in the Black community pages. We put out some network graphs showing this. There were 30 or so fake pages targeting the Black community, Instagram accounts targeting the Black community. And what they did was they really worked to ingratiate themselves with real small Black media, right? With real kind of micromedia. Again, the authentic people who were doing the same thing, saying mainstream media doesn't tell our stories. We're going to tell our own stories. And that's a, you know, very valid critique of mainstream media. And so the Russians just replicated it. And then they in turn also were, you know, reposting and resharing authentic Black media, and then trying to get reciprocity where they in turn had their fake pages and accounts reshared as well. And this is what they were doing to kind of grow their followers. So we did, again, both this kind of quantitative assessment of how did they grow their followers? What were the mechanics? What was the process by which this happened? How were the dissemination pathways laid out across, again, the entirety of the social ecosystem? And then there was the qualitative work, which really involved, you know, a lot of, honestly, a lot of looking at memes there. I mean, you can use things like OCR, right? Which is optical character recognition. You can pull out the text of the meme, and you can, you know, do a bunch of kind of like language processing. But at the same time, you kind of want to go and look at the stuff. And so I would just sit there just arrowing through these hundreds of thousands of memes. And, you know, I got to say, it's really useful to do that work, to do that qualitative work, because you get a sense for not only what are they saying, but what tone are they taking? Is this funny? Is it ironic? How does the image match up with the text? Also, where does the image come from, right? That's where there was a lot of work to try to figure out, were these unique images that they had made, or were they cribbing memes from existing media? The answer was, particularly for the conservative media pages, they were cribbing from, you know, from outlets like Turning Point USA that do a very good job producing content to rile up a particular segment of the population. And so why would you reinvent the wheel when you can just take that content and slap your own label on it? And so they were just kind of taking existing memes and slapping their own logo on it, kind of trying to brand it so that when people saw the meme, they would come and follow their page. So again, there's this recognition that you were constantly audience building, constantly working to engage with a very, very specific subset. There were 30-something pages targeting the Black community, but they weren't all the same. Some focused on culture, some focused on religion, one focused on people with incarcerated spouses. You know, there was a real breadth of experience in there so that everybody they cared to reach could find a page that was kind of tailor-made for their particular identity.
Totally. It's like they're kind of taking this obsession we have with identity politics and really boiling us down to these sort of, I am of this identity and therefore I believe X.
Right. And that was the language they used too. So the other thing is, you know, with propaganda, you can either write as if, you know, you're sort of the authority from on high, right? And you see that in more media style content. This is I am a reputable journalist telling this story. I am a person on the ground in Syria reporting out about the conflict, right? And that was how the GRU, which was also operating at the time, was, you know, Russian military intelligence, used that tone, right? As a think tank analyst at this place, here is my opinion on the Syrian conflict. Whereas the Internet Research Agency was, I am just like you. As, you know, as women, we shouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton because her husband's a rapist, for example. You know, that was and so it was never, you shouldn't vote. It was, we shouldn't vote, which is a different tone. It makes you believe that the person who's speaking to you is just like you. And so there's a receptivity there, perhaps, that is common to the experience of following an influencer on social media. They're relatable, they're accessible.
Mm-hmm. And certainly antithetical toward mass media that doesn't kind of talk about those lived experiences. So you can see why these things would catch on. So you have this really interesting example that you came across on Twitter. And basically, you found that there were a lot of pages set up with MAGA, with like Make America Great Again and like eagles and very like pro-American. And the kind of intent of these pages was to seed pro-Trump messages. Now, I think you found that not all of those pages were actually Americans, but they blended into the community, like you were mentioning before, of the sort of authentic voices from those communities. So can you talk a little bit about what happens when a sort of authentic voice from that community might collide or combine with a Russian fake page? Like, how does the tone of that conversation change, or does it?
You know, the very common critique, you know, when we ask the question, did this matter, is that there are many pages with far larger follower counts than anything the Russians were able to pull together. I think the max hit for them was right around 500,000 in terms of audience size. Whereas, you know, some of these kind of conservative influencer pages who are saying largely the same thing, or, you know, Black influencer pages or feminist influencer pages, or, you know, pick your subset, do have far larger audiences. But one of the things that I think gets lost a little bit is that a lot of the goal of propaganda is not to persuade, right? It's not to make people think something new. And they did a little bit of nudging, right? But they were running ads and doing audience building to find people who already believed the things that the page was going to say, right? So finding members of that identity. And then once they had members of that identity, they were trying to nudge them just a little bit. I'll give one example, since you raised the conservative pages, during the primary, right? So originally, the pages were really actively, particularly the ones that were pretending to be Tea Partiers, trying to back Rand Paul. And so they were talking about how Rand Paul was the clear choice for conservatives voting in the primary. And they quickly begin to realize that, you know, Paul's candidacy was something of a non-starter, right? And so then, as they're looking at what's, you know, kind of left on the table, you see them go for Donald Trump. And they do that by really trying to move people away from Ted Cruz. So again, there are these Tea Party pages, particularly the ones, you know, there were also some targeting Texans, specifically the Texas secessionists, right? And Ted Cruz is a Texan, right? And so they have to do their work to get their followers away from this candidate they would kind of innately support. And so you see them again saying, like, well, you know, I mean, I've been a Texan for years, but I just don't think Ted Cruz is it, you know. And so it's kind of, again, it's done as like a nudge, right? How do we move people? You're not going to move a Democrat over to Donald Trump, but you could probably move a, you know, you could make a plausible case that Trump is the future of the party and we need to get there and support him. And that's what you see them do in the early days of the primary. One of the real challenges and limitations with the work that I did comes from the data set that I was given, which is I can see this was the tone of the post. I can see that this is what they were saying, and I can see that there were dozens and dozens of responses, but I can't actually tell you what the responses said. And that's where this question of does the persuasive nudge work is something that unfortunately anybody outside of Facebook or anybody outside of the platforms that gather these data sets will never be able to answer. We just didn't, you know, we could see that there were comments, we could see that there were engagements, but we could not see what they said. So that's actually a really big gap. And one of the reasons why I try to caveat whenever I discuss what I was able to do, what I had to study, is, you know, I can tell you what they tried. I cannot tell you how, you know, to what extent they succeeded.
Well, thank you for that caveat. You testified before the Senate's Intelligence Committee, CISI, and confirmed it will be increasingly hard for Americans to trust what they see in our online information ecosystem. And you said that this problem is one of the defining threats of our generation. So this definitely brings up a lot, you know, a lot of philosophical questions. I was actually talking to Brian Jones last week, you know, how much of what we are doing on the internet is actually free will versus singularity. So I want to kind of unpack that a little bit. I wonder if I could just get your thoughts on like those aspects of technological singularity and autonomy on the internet.
Yeah, well, I think, so my testimony for CISI was the fact that this work was being done was actually not public during that committee hearing. You know, it kind of came out a little bit later. But it was alarming at the time to see how effectively targeted things were. And again, the follower counts they were able to amass, the way that they were you know, able to engage so effectively to get people to go out for in the streets protests, right? I mean, like, this wasn't something that was happening only online. There were also efforts to infiltrate activist communities and things like that. And again, you know, there has never been a shortage of various state actors, you know, foreign and domestic, trying to infiltrate protest movements. But it's so easy when you think you're talking to somebody who's just like you, who's a fellow activist offering you resources and, you know, pretending to help you lead your protests and things like that. So it was a little bit alarming to me the extent to which it was being reported as if it was just like some memes on Facebook, when in reality, they had really, in a way, kind of taken the old model of agents of influence, the old models of propaganda, and just done such an effective job showing what was possible with, you know, relatively little effort and relatively low budget. At the same time, though, even then, again, the recognition that this was a tool and that anybody who was so inclined could pick it up and use it, right? And so we had networked activist movements, and you didn't want to shut that down or stifle freedom of expression because some bad state actors across the pond were doing something, you know, shifty. But at the same time, there was also the recognition that deeply incentivized partisan actors were going to be doing this too, right? And that it was basically just kind of a vast influence machine, and whoever wanted to pick it up and use it now all of a sudden had that power. So, you know, I had actually gotten into this work by looking at the anti-vaccine movement in 2015, right, which was wholly domestic. And, you know, and the recognition of like what you could achieve in terms of follower count and growth and reaching audiences and recruiting people into groups with, you know, upwards of 100,000 people, you know, just to grow a social movement. I thought that that was a particularly, you know, again, so now we had activists doing it. We had terrorists doing it, again, the ISIS work. We had state actors doing it. And so it for me was this recognition that it was kind of like a free-for-all, this sort of war of all against all that was going to play out on these platforms, and that the future was going to be who could most effectively segment and then activate their segment. Now, this is where politics had been going for a long time, not necessarily converting the person across the aisle, but just turning out your people. And I thought this is really interesting because it incentivizes the growth of these very highly activist factions. And I felt that that would be kind of a pretty significant societal shift. And that was the thing that was most disturbing about it for me, was that propaganda was democratized and participatory. And that was where it wasn't even we're heading. That was where we had gotten. It was just that not everybody had realized it yet.
So, I mean, what do you think can be done from an algorithmic or technological perspective? Is there something these platforms can do but aren't doing? What do you think about that?
Well, on the state actor front, they're actually doing quite a lot. I mean, my team at Stanford Internet Observatory, you know, every couple months or so, we participate in a process of evaluating a takedown. Some platform has found some network, and we serve as kind of independent third-party eyes on it, saying, again, the quantitative and qualitative analysis, here's the network, here's how it worked, where it was, reach, you know, et cetera, summary stats. And then here is our analysis of the kind of qualitative side. Here's what they wanted to achieve, the narratives they chose to use, the themes and how they tie into either government interest or political party interests. Now, one thing you may have noticed is that Facebook and Twitter, about 6 months ago now, announced that they were developing policies for what they called coordinated authentic behavior, right? So a lot of the policies in the immediate aftermath of the Russia investigation focused on identifying inauthentic actors and inauthentic behaviors, you know. And so the question then became, okay, well, what is the role? You know, how do we think about the authentic stuff that uses perhaps inauthentic distribution? Like, where should the line for that be? And so they have begun to try to refine that a little bit more carefully. They've been trying to expand the types of researchers that have access to it. You know, I think that this is kind of an ongoing process. It is always going to be an ongoing process, right? I mean, the technology evolves so quickly, and anytime there's a new platform, you reshuffle what's possible, right? Whenever there's a new feature that's kind of mass democratized, the live stream, for example, a couple of years back, what you know, what does that do to the political conversation? What does that do to networked activism? How do we think about a new technology, not in a platform sense, not in a brand sense, but in a conceptual sense? GPT-3, for example, generative text. What does that do to the information environment? So a lot of what we're doing, and you know, what the platforms are doing too, is trying to think through where are we headed and how do we kind of red team out and envision what is coming as part of our thinking about what can be done to mitigate the worst harms. I do think that it has to be a harms-based approach. I mean, the internet is massive and content moderation and fact-checking is, you know, it's like, I don't have a good metaphor for you. It's like it's like bailing out a sinking ship with a cup or something. Yeah.
Yes. It's the needle in the haystack, all those metaphors.
Yeah, exactly. And so it turns into like, well, you know, is fact-checking going to save us? No. So there's more important things to think about, I would argue. Like, how do we structure our networks? I think that's really a key foundational question. What does it mean for a recommender system to suggest that people should join a group or be friends or, you know, follow a person? There's a really interesting question there with regard to how should things be curated? Because that's what that is. That's a form of curation. And should it be... Right now, it's very much kind of a winner-take-all flywheel where if you are popular, then you will get more popular, right? And so the incentives that make someone popular sometimes are sensationalism and, you know, and outrage. And maybe that's not the best thing to be curating, right? And so there's a lot to ask with regard to how are our networks shaped that's content agnostic as well. You know, we're not making these determinations based on what political party someone is linked to or something like that. But what are the criteria that go into thinking through how to assemble a healthy information environment that maximizes freedom of expression while minimizing harm? And again, recognizes that harm is a thing we should be able to quantify. And in order to get to that, we need transparency. And this is where I think some of the foundational legislation and policymaking work has to focus on transparency and data access. Because right now, a lot of what happens, a lot of the theories presented are speculative. You know, even as I noted in my answer related to what was the impact of the Russian activity, I can't tell you that, right? I don't know. Should I know? Like, yeah, somebody should, even if it's not me, you know, somebody outside of a platform should know for sure. But is it a moral panic? Did it matter? What worked and what didn't? Like, we should be able to answer those questions at this point.
Thank you so much, Renee, for being here. And I wish we could talk for hours.
It's great to chat with you.
Oh, it was great to chat with you too. And I'll be sure to point listeners into other places where they can hear you speak and talk about some of these important issues. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the day.
So there are numerous other ways to hear Renee talk about these topics. She did a 3-hour interview with Joe Rogan on his podcast, so y'all can check that out, as well as her testimony before Congress and the Senate. It's all online, and her website is a good place to point you in the direction of additional talks. A Lot of Good People Told Me is produced and hosted by me, Alex Rose, a graduate Brumley Fellow at the Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas at Austin. The music you hear was composed by Alex Dupree, who also edited every episode and served as a crucial production partner. For more information, please visit alexrosebb.com or strausscenter.org. You can also follow us on Instagram @A Lot of Good People Told Me. Thanks for listening.